The reason I asked Dr. Lorenz to take part in this session is because she's been a huge advocate for APSA, both at the local or regional meetings that we hold, as well as just at the UAB chapter. And I'll let you tell, I'll let her tell you a little bit about more about herself in a little while, but I just wanted to briefly say she's from Oklahoma. She got her bachelor's at Stanford University before going over to Washington University in St. Louis to pursue her MD and PhD. And then she actually did a residency program in clinical pathology and also did a postdoc in GI biology. And she's had a, she looks like a great career, a lot of different hats she currently wears, it looks like. She's been the director of the UAB MSTP for the past 8 years. She's now the assistant dean for physician scientist education for a little over 1 year. And is also the associate director of the pathology residency training program. So a lot of administrative roles. And she also served as the president of the ACLPS, which is the Academy of Clinical Laboratory Physicians and Scientists. She is active in research, has a good number of peer-reviewed publications, and is NIH-funded for her work. And so I think that's enough of an introduction for now. And Dr. Lorenz, I'll just start with the first question, and then we've got a good number on here. After I ask the question, you guys feel free to chime in. If you want to, you can either write your question in the chat box, or else you can unmute your microphone and then ask it from there. So, Dr. Lorenz, here's the first question. So, would you mind pointing out some of the formative experiences in your career that brought you to where you are today?
So, I think that's actually a really good question because it's one of my real passions from physician scientist education is how to get students exposed to this type of pathway and to determine whether or not becoming a physician scientist is really what they want to do. And so, actually, the way I got started, you mentioned I was from Oklahoma. I actually originally did a summer program as a high school student at the Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation, and that's really what ignited my interest in research and in science. And then when I went to Stanford University, I was a work-study student there to pay for part of my tuition, and because I'd done science before, I was able to get a work-study job where I actually could do research for my work-study job. And that really opened all of the doors that I've been able to do since then. And I think the other thing that I would argue was formative in me becoming a physician scientist was the residency program that I did. You mentioned that I was a clinical pathologist. Those of you that are not familiar with pathology, there really are sort of two types of pathology. Clinical pathology and anatomic pathology. And probably what most of you think of when you think of pathology is actually anatomic pathology. That's where you do autopsies. That's where the pathologists look at frozen sections that the surgeons take out to see if there's cancer, that sort of thing. I actually do something completely different from that. I actually oversee our clinical immunology lab and work in transfusion medicine. We are the pathologists that work with sort of the liquid part of the body, and that actually is very fits very well with being a scientist because we're running tests on all of those samples. We're trying to determine what new types of tests we can run, and because I did a clinical pathology residency, I was able to do a couple of years of research while I was in residency, and that really helped propel me on my career.
Great. Does anyone have any questions? It looks like we have about 30 people or 32 people on the call, so whoever wants can just go ahead and ask a question. And don't be shy if you're an undergrad, MD, PhD student, resident, fellow, whoever you are, just feel free.
So I see there's a number of undergrads.
Hi, my name is...
So... Are you all nervous about your applications? Are you in the middle of the process? Do you have your applications sent in? Any questions about the process?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so my name is Zachary Kiss, and one of the questions that I had is, in the current pre-med application climate, it seems like if you would like to pursue a physician scientist type career, you have to make that decision relatively early in your academic career. And as a post-bac, I think it's a little bit more difficult for me because the amount of lab experiences that I have to accumulate have to be accumulated within a very much shorter window of time. I was wondering if you had any suggestions or advice for my situation in particular.
So I think there's actually sort of two answers to your question. I mean, one is when we look at our applicant pool right now, and I think most of the MD-PhD programs in the United States, we have a lot of students who actually have taken off, a couple of years, 2-3 years, doing research after undergraduate. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. One is as you suggested, maybe they discovered late that they were interested in doing research and didn't have the time to do it when they were undergrads, or maybe they were an athlete, or other things that they couldn't fit it in. And so they've done several years after they have graduated. And honestly, that type of applicant is someone that really appeals to us because we know they've done full-time research and we know that they know what research is like and they want to do that as part of their career. And so that actually is something, taking off a couple of years is something that we see actually increasingly now in the last few years. The other option, and one that we also see quite our programs actually accept students out of school, go to medical school. They will discover later in medical school that they want to do MD-PhD, and a lot of our programs you can apply out of medical school. And if you've done some research in the first 2 years of medical school and you've done well in medical school, then often that's a way that you can actually apply and get into an MD-PhD program also. And then I think finally the other option, and one that perhaps is a little more difficult, I would argue, but one that is doable, is you can do the research when you're a resident or a fellow. And you still have to put the years in to learn how to do research, and it's a little bit more difficult because the burden on you to learn, how to run a lab, how to write a grant, et cetera, whereas we teach you how to do those things in a PhD program. But you can do that. Actually, I have a pediatric surgeon in my lab right now who's a regular MD, and he's going to be embedded in my lab for the next couple of years in order to really learn how to be a physician scientist and run his own lab. So those are all options, but certainly continuing on in your post-bac and getting the experience there is, I think, something you're doing the right thing if that's what you want to do and become an MD.
Well, thanks. I that definitely makes me feel a little bit better about the whole process. And my strategy now, I think, is just I realized when I was in the post-bac program that I really wanted more science because pathology is something that I'm keenly interested in, and I realized that it's critically important to have a really good understanding of what's going on the molecular level. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent approach.
Well, thank you.
Other questions?
Dr. Lorenz, I'll ask another one while people are thinking. So I'm just asking broad questions, but I know you're doing a lot of administration, so how do you currently balance your time between research, clinical hours, and then your administrative hours?
It's a good question because I think it's something that people, when you're a student and you're just starting into training, I think it's a little hard to imagine how, as we go through our careers, we actually have a lot of flexibility with how we balance everything. I actually think that's one of the strongest draws of doing MD-PhD, is because you have both the clinical and the research training, you actually can sort of switch back and forth depending on what's happening with your career. I actually did probably about 80% of my time doing research, running my research lab, actually doing some experiments, or that'd be nice to do now, and about 20% of my time doing clinical work. Now, because I've taken on so many administrative responsibilities, I actually probably spend about 50% of my time doing administrative work. I spend another about 15% of my time doing clinical work. And then the rest of my time is overseeing my research lab. And my lab is now smaller right now than it has been in the past because I spend a little bit less time overseeing the basic science research. My research, I think I didn't really mention that,
I actually run mucosal immunology lab. I train, my PhD was in basic immunology, antigen processing and presentation. I moved into doing gastroenterology research, and now I combine those two and do animal models and inflammatory bowel disease. The nice thing is that you can go where your passion leads you, and since I've become an NDPHD director, and I really have found that I have a passion for helping to train students and helping to give students advice and help about becoming physician scientists, and so I've tended to now start doing more percentage of my time doing those types of activities.
Dr. Lorenz, I don't know if you can hear me. This is Alex Adami. I think
Stephanie.
Yeah, can you hear me?
All right. Go, Alex, and then we'll go the other.
Yeah, there's someone asked a question, and because I think I logged in also as the organizer account, it only went to me, so I just want to make sure it doesn't get missed. But someone named David asked a question, says, to Dr. Lorenz, do you feel that you could fulfill your duties and pursue the opportunities that you have been able to have if you would only earn the medical degree?
So I think that's a good question, because a lot of people have that concern that is there any real advantage? And I think that the bottom line answer is, could I have done everything I do right now with an MD and not a PhD? And I think that the answer is, in general, yes. However, I think that the training that you get as a PhD in how to approach science, how to come up with hypotheses, how to come up with ways to address those hypotheses, how to run a lab, all of those things are things you have to learn at some point in time if you're going to do research. And I just feel like it's a little easier to learn those things by being in a PhD program where you are sort of given the classes and given the structure to learn that. Whereas if you learn that when you're a resident or a fellow, you actually have to go search out your own mentors and you have to search out the people that are going to help you learn those. I think right now the only real data out there that shows that having the MD-PhD versus the regular MD is the fact that MD-PhDs tend to have a slightly higher increase percentage of grants funded, but it's not really a significantly higher number. Yes, you can do it with only an MD, but you have to be the kind of person who's going to search out and get those opportunities to help you. And I think most people right now are arguing that that's even harder than it used to be when I trained, because all of the increasing pressures on the clinical services to actually make money. And so there's not as much time for those clinicians to say, hey, you know, I want to go take a couple of years to research. You have to be in the right environment. You have to have the right division chair or division chief or chair that's going to believe in you and give you that time in order to learn the techniques that you need. And I also see there's another question here from Stephanie says, taking a year or two to gain more research experience will taking the MCAT this year be viewed negatively when compared to applicants who have taken the new MCAT? And I think the answer to that is absolutely not. I think we all, if we were in your place, we would take the MCAT before it changes, because we realize that most of you that have gone to school a few years ago didn't necessarily take the coursework that you need to take the new section. We are going to accept that regular MCAT for several more years because it's good for usually 3 years, and we would not see that as a negative. I would say, if at all possible, go ahead and take it now so that you don't get tripped up by the new section if you're not ready for it. And then once everybody starts taking the new MCAT, then we're still going to be comparing to the old MCAT for a couple of years, because there's going to be applicants that have taken it in the past and are reapplying and that sort of thing. So we're going to be used to seeing both MCATs either way. So the next question here is from Zahara, which is about balance. an undergrad in engineering, did research as an undergrad, worked for nonprofits, now in academics. Will it look bad to return to engineering before you apply? I think that the question would be whether or not that engineering includes any type of research or R&D. And it would also depend on what type of graduate program you're looking for. If you're thinking of going into something like biomedical engineering, then I don't think that's going to be seen as a negative at all, because that type of experience is going to be seen as a positive. If you're thinking of, you know, going into some kind of biomedical science, and that engineering doesn't really have that much application to it, then it may not be seen as in as much of a positive light. But it also kind of depends on how much other research you have and how much you can show that you know what research is, and that you want to continue research in the future. Let's see. Okay, so this is a question about MD-PhD programs that allow MDs to apply to the dual degree program but preclude PhDs from doing the same. So so I can directly answer that, because our program actually just 2 years ago decided to allow PhDs to apply to the MD-PhD program, and we have allowed MDs to apply to our program for a number of years. And the thought process behind it really comes from the fact that the preparation for medical school and preparation for graduate school are different. And so in order to get at our school, at least, in order to get accepted into the MD-PhD program out of the PhD program, they still require you to take the MCAT. And so sometimes it's a very difficult thing for students that are already in PhD programs to find the time to actually study for and take the MCAT, and then to also find the time to do the type of shadowing and that sort of thing that the medical school wants to see to convince them that you actually do want to be a physician. And when we've seen this successfully done from PhD to MD-PhD, usually it is from a person who is actually in a lab that has a physician scientist mentor, or they're in a project that they actually have worked a lot with physicians or physician scientists. And so from that, how they got exposed to the career, and therefore, you know, made the decision that they wanted to become an MD-PhD. And the second thing is, and this is true for both, at least in our school, from people applying from the MD program or the straight PhD program, we require the students to actually be fairly early in the process. So, for instance, our PhDs have to apply before they have done their qualifying exam, because if they don't, then there's really no way for us to do the integration between the MD and PhD. So if you've already almost completed your PhD and all you're doing then is transferring over to do medical school, then that sort of negates the positive aspects of the MD-PhD program, because we like to have integration from both the clinical side and the research side throughout the whole program. And so if you transfer too late in the process, in our case that's true on the MD side or the PhD side, then you don't get the positives of the dual program. And so that's why there's some restrictions on that.
I do think that's quite wise to do that. I also was thinking about the timing of that application process, and my follow-up question you already answered, which was, would you give preference or would you encourage students to apply before or after the qualifying exam? Because I think the qualifying exam is an important milestone to reach as a PhD student.
Yeah, it is, and I think that, you know, it actually, in our program, it is a little problematic coming out of the PhD side, because we actually require the students then to put their PhD project hold and go to medical school for 2 years and work on the PhD project in the summer. And so if you're on a really hot project that, you know, you really need to go full force on and you can't wait for a couple of years, or you can't finish up the part you're working on and then start something new when you come back, then you may not want to stop and do the MD because you know, you want to get going on the research and get that research out. So sometimes it works with the timing and sometimes it doesn't. The other thing is there are now a couple of PhD to MD programs out there. There's one at Tulane and one at Columbia that shortened the MD training process to either 3 years or 3.5 years for PhDs. And that's also another way to potentially get the dual degree, but not necessarily within an MD-PhD program. Okay.
That's interesting.
I'm currently in the process of applying. Good luck to you, Shannon. And don't hold your breath. It's a long process. One of my major concerns is that I was not able to take on any formal leadership roles because I had to work. Do I think that will hurt? So one thing I always respect in an applicant is someone who's been able to juggle more than one thing, okay? And in some cases, that may be that you're in a group or you're a leader and you're also doing your studies. In other cases, you're a athlete and being able to do your studies. In your case, it sounds like you had to work and then also keep up your studies. And I would just make sure that that comes across in your application, that you know, this was a component of your of how you had to approach college. And you know, a lot of our applications are supplemental applications. We'll ask, can you tell us anything else about yourself that we need to know? And I would talk about that because I think that you know, and say that because you had to work X number of hours to in order to support your education, you were not as able to do extracurricular activities. Because you're correct, if you don't have any extracurriculars or not very many, and we don't know why, then that might be considered a negative. But if there's a reason behind it, then that would negate that, and we would take that into account. Okay. Is somebody on the phone? Okay, so let me go to David. How much flexibility is there in the structure of the program? Can you take more time to finish your PhDs? Okay, so this is actually a very program-specific question. Okay, so each one of our programs actually does this a little bit differently. So there are programs in the United States that allow you to do 1 year of medical school and then start your PhD. The majority of programs have you do 2 years of medical school, which are your preclinical years, and then move over and work on your PhD thesis. There are now some programs that actually, there are a few programs that actually have you do 3 years, which is your first 2 preclinical years and your third clerkship year, and then you start your PhD. And those programs tend to have students that want to do more translational or clinical type research because they can use that clinical training to help them with their research. And so different programs are organized very differently, and it's worthwhile thinking about what you want, and that may help you think about which programs you want to apply to. Now, as far as how long the PhD is, most of our programs, the national average for MD-PhD is a little over 8 years. And so since medical school is about 4, that means that most people are spending about 4 years doing their PhD. But all of our programs have a range. So, I mean, just this year in my program, I had one student that finished in 3 years, and I had one student that finished in 6. So, in their PhD years. So how long your PhD takes really depends on your thesis and how that thesis is going, how the experiments go, how your publications are going, and that's actually decided by your thesis committee. Okay, so Brandon, currently fine also. Good luck to you. And Brandon, do I recognize your name? Are you coming to the Southeast Medical Sciences Symposium? Maybe you can reply and let me know. Oh, you are good. Fantastic. We will see you in Atlanta. That's an ASPA, that's the Southeast Symposium, which is sponsored by UAB, Vanderbilt, and Emory. It's actually in Atlanta this year, and it's August, I think it's 23rd and 24th, for those of you who are undergrads on here. We actually do have a few undergrad travel awards still available for that, so if you're interested in going and applying, you can go to just put in FEMSS, the physician scientist, and it will come up and you can see the information. So now to Brandon's question, let's see if I lost, here it is. How do you see applicants who do poorly on a first MCAT attempt and retake with a much better score? Just to answer your question, if you get a low MCAT and don't retake it, then that's then basically I think you don't really want to get into an MD-PhD program. So getting a low MCAT, retaking it, and doing better then is seen as a very positive thing. And we all understand that maybe people just didn't realize how much they needed to prepare. Maybe they had a bad day. mean, I had a student in my lab that basically got sick that day and threw up in the middle of one of the sessions and scored poorly. So all know these things happen. And so taking it again and scoring better is seen as a very positive thing. If you take it in August, that means the date is not going to come back until late September. That is getting pretty late in the process, and so I would say that any of the programs you're really interested in, you need to touch base with them and let them know that you're going to retake it in August so they can hold on to your application and quickly retake a look at it once you get your MCAT score back. Annie, how important are research credentials for an administrative career? Well, that's a very good question, because the answer is probably not. Administration is something that, as a physician scientist, we actually are not very well trained for. I mean, we don't get very many business courses. We don't get courses in how to handle people. We don't get courses in conflict management. So there's a lot of things that I do as an administrator that I certainly never had any formal training in. And a lot of it is learning on the job. And I think that the administrators that end up doing well and continue on and advance are the ones that pick it up. The others perhaps, you know, go on to do other things. The one thing that I think research does help you is, in order to run a research lab, it is actually a little bit like running a small business. So you have budgets, you have personnel. You know, you have to manage time, make sure all the, you know, you have the supplies to do the experiments, et cetera. And so that part of it, that type of management and oversight is something that is useful when you move into different types of administrative responsibilities. Let's see, where are we here?
Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. I had a follow-up to that, actually.
Okay.
So I had a bit of business training before I attended medical school, and I'm hoping that I have some sort of administration in my career. I'm just not sure when exactly. I was wondering if you could give me your perspective on at what point in your career were you given a significant role, I would say, in administration, and did you have to be you touched on this earlier, but did you have to be well-known?
Did you have to be well-known
with research or with your skills clinically before you were given the role?
So I think the answer to that is really no, because I actually became co-director of our residency program at Washington University fairly quickly in my career. And I don't know if I know the real answer to why, other than I'm not afraid to speak my mind and say how I think things could be improved. And so then I think perhaps then they say, well, just go ahead and do it. And so I think that if doing some things in administration is something that appeals to you, then once you finish your clinical training and get out of residency and fellowship, then I would start looking for those opportunities. And actually, I would even say within residency and fellowship, start looking for opportunities where you can take leadership roles, see that you can do things, you can do those, or resident, hospital committees. I'm hearing an echo where that's coming from. But those are all things that you can do to show your administration that, you know, you could take on that type of job. Okay, so here's Jenny. So Jenny's currently in residency and has been doing research for the past 8 years in different fields and wants to do epidemiology and then practice medicine. Are there drawbacks to pursuing an MPH versus a PhD? Actually, this is something we've debated here because we actually have had several students who I've counseled about whether or not they should transfer into the MD-PhD program versus just getting the MD-MPH. And I think that when talking to people that have MPHs or doctors of public health, the bottom line seems to be what kind of position do you want in the research team. Usually the ones that are writing the grants, you know, overseeing the large research projects, tend to be the ones with the PhDs or the doctors of public health. Whereas if you're on the ground actually doing the research, collecting the data, interacting with the teams, then usually that's where you see the MPHs. So I say you thinking about sort of where you see yourself and what role you see yourself in the long term might help you answer that question. Now, obviously, it's much faster to get the MPH than the PhD. And so, you know, if you've been out a lot of years already and you're not so sure whether you want to spend another 4 or 5 years getting a PhD, that also might be a consideration. Okay. And in terms of funding opportunities, I actually don't know that I know the real answer to that. I haven't actually looked at the funding percentages of MD MPHs versus MD PhDs. So I'm actually not sure about that. Okay, Mark, I dedicate a lot of time to research. If I reduce my course load to make time for this, will it hurt my competitiveness?
These questions that people have.
So course load, realistically, what we're looking for is that you have the sound foundation to do well in medical school and to do well in graduate school. So, you know, you need to have, all of the core courses that medical school looks for, inorganic chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, a reasonable amount of biology, some writing, math, and if you are, say, a biology major, then we're looking for you to have a number of upper-level biology courses. If you're a sociology major, then we would look for you to have the upper-level courses in that, okay? But we clearly feel like the research is critical, and so you don't have to be overloading every semester or every quarter on coursework. You should be spending a reasonable amount of time doing your research, but we also don't want to see that, you're just taking jogging 101, for 5 credit hours. So we need to see that you're challenging yourself, but not necessarily that you're doing it so much that you don't have time to.
Yes. Hey, I'm Mark. I'm an undergrad at the University of Florida. Thank you for answering that.
Mark, what else can I answer for you? Does that help?
Well, I'm just trying to pick classes for the next semester, and I've been asking a lot of people whether or not it's a problem if I end up only taking 12 or 13 credit hours because I'm going to be taking 2 labs that are each going to require 6 hours of my time every week. And, those labs are low credit, so.
Are the labs for credit?
Yes, the labs are for credit, but they're only 1 credit. So the number of credits makes it look like I'm not taking that many classes.
I see. I mean, I think that as long as it's clear that you've been spending a reasonable amount of time in research, it's probably not. I mean, honestly, you're thinking we look at your transcripts a little closer than we do.
Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you for that then.
Okay, Stephanie. I attend a newer, lesser-known school than most MD-PhD students. How can I compensate for this? How much does the student undergrad institution? So you're, Stephanie, I'm assuming you're an undergrad right now and thinking of applying to MD-PhD programs. So I think that it probably depends a little bit on what school you're applying to. There are some of the larger, well-known schools on various coasts that we won't specifically talk about that tend to like to take students from well-known schools. However, there are a lot of MD-PhD programs that are more than willing to give students a chance as long as you've got the research backgrounds, you've got the grades, you've got the MCATs, and you've got the passion for doing this pathway. We actually have a student in our program from a school where he's PhD student ever at school. So I think that, as long as you can show us that the school has given you the appropriate academic training to do the medical school coursework and the graduate school coursework, then where the school you're from is not such a big concern. Georgia, another applicant, okay. Friends who are applying to MD programs have done 20 or more. For MD PhD programs, should you narrow your choices? I think that what you need to do is a little bit like what you probably did when you applied to undergrad school, okay? So So you need to think of how strong you are as an applicant, and then come up with a few schools that are maybe reach schools, a few schools that are a little bit more within your comfort zone. Now, that being said, there's no guarantees about getting into an MD-PhD program, okay? So I can tell you from personal experience, because my son was in the applicant pool last year, that, you know, you can have schools that will, you know, two schools obviously looking at exactly the same application. Both schools are probably equally prestigious, and one of them won't give you an interview at all, and the other one makes you an offer. So, you know, there's not necessarily a lot of rhyme or reason sometimes to how the application decisions are made, or at least that's the way it seems to the applicants, I think. And so you have to apply to a reasonable number within sort of the reach of what you think your application can be. So if you're, you know, you've got that first off a Nature paper and that MCAT of 40 and that 4.0, you know, then go ahead and go to the top 10 schools, and that may be all you need to apply to. You know, if that's not you, then I would say that then you go, you know, to some of the middle schools, and actually you need to apply. I think most people are applying to around 15 or so. I think the average last year was 14 for MD.
Okay.
David, let's see. I've gotten a lot of advice to take as much math as possible, whereas my pre-med advisor is advised taking very little. Okay. At the intersection of two careers, how much math and statistics do you need? Okay, so I would argue, A, I don't have enough. Okay. That's actually probably one of my weaknesses. I did not have a lot of math because I came from a very tiny high school in rural Oklahoma, and so I didn't take a lot of math classes at college other than what I had to because I wasn't comfortable in the subject. And so now I can do basic statistics that are necessary for my lab experiments, but, you know, when it comes to doing big data, informatics, all those sorts of things, I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage now because I don't have that kind of background. If you like math and you're good at it, or you like the challenge that it gives you, then I would say go ahead and take it. I don't think you should shy away from taking courses just because you're worried you're not going to get an A in them. You know, we like to see that students have challenged themselves, and we are not looking for students that have perfect 4.0 GPA. You know, you could get that by taking very wimpy courses, and that wouldn't show us somebody that wants to be a physician scientist and wants to continue thinking about things, always asking questions, always trying to really push themselves to do the best that they can. I scared everybody.
Dr. Lorenz, I have a question. This is Peter.
Okay.
So this is not directly relevant to me, but it's an issue I hear a lot about increasing diversity in MD-PhD programs and in science. And I was wondering what type of challenges you've faced as a female clinician, scientist, administrator over your career. And have you found it more difficult than maybe looking at your male counterparts?
So I have to admit that I don't necessarily think that my career has been more difficult than my male counterparts. Now, that being said, I think that there are differences. And some of those differences end up are pretty obvious to women or minorities in science, which is that there's not as many of us. And so we tend to get asked from more committees, you know, maybe we get asked to, you know, go give more talks, et cetera, and so on. And so sometimes that makes us a little bit busier than our, you know, sort of male counterparts, who I actually think maybe sometimes think about the fact that they aren't progressing quite as fast as we are because they didn't get those. So I think it's a good example. So my husband is also a physician scientist. He's an MD-PhD, graduated MD-PhD from Stanford, is also a pathologist, is actually chair of pathology here at UAB. But I was chair of an NIH study section probably 5 years before he was, even though he's 5 years older than I am. And so, you know, is that because I'm so much better? Probably not. So, you know, it wasn't because I was, you know, pushed a little bit because, you know, I was female. Could have been. Who knows? So I think that's one of the things, but there's positives to that and there's negatives to that. I think the other thing that's different is, you know, even though there's a little bit better balance for working families now between working men and working women as far as taking care of children and that sort of thing, it's still the woman has to have the children and the woman is the one who ends up, you know, doing a lot of the child care in most families. And so you have to learn how to juggle that. And I think that's made me much more efficient. It's made me much more organized. And I think that's one of the reasons that I actually can juggle several different hats in my job now is because I actually have learned those techniques as I move through my career.
Great. Other folks with questions, you can feel free to unmute your microphone and ask.
Okay, so are there PhD programs during the residency or fellowship years? And the answer to that is yes. So there are programs, not at all schools, but there are programs. So, for instance, there's a program called the STAR program at UCLA. There's a program at Stanford that allows a PhD during a residency or fellowship. We actually do it on an ad hoc basis here at UAB. There was a neonatologist who actually did his PhD in my lab while he was finishing his neonatology fellowship and was a junior faculty member. So, and a number of schools allow that to happen. And actually, I think we're seeing a little bit more of that out in various schools. And so that is one way to sort of still get the formal training of a PhD, but to get it a little bit later on. And one of the advantages of doing that way, actually, just to sort of, you know, give the opposite opinion of the, you know, MD-PhD program, one of the advantages of getting the PhD later after you've finished your medical training and actually are already in residency and fellowship, you probably have narrowed down a lot what type of research you want to do, and you'll be doing research and working on models that are probably going to be what you want to work on for the rest of your career. And so sometimes some people think that's a little bit better because you actually are sort of, you know, now doing what you want to do. My most and least favorite parts of my job. So I think my least favorite part of my job is when I have to call in one of my students and talk to them about maybe they're not doing so well or I need to put them on probation to try to get them back on track. It's a necessary part of the job. It's something that I kind of wish I didn't have to do because I would prefer to, you know, be talking to them about the positives of things going on and how, how to get further on in their career. And I think that really, though, the thing I like the most about my job is also the students because it really is, you know, to see a student finish the MD-PhD program, go on into residency and fellowship, talk to them a few years later. I actually went to Philadelphia about a few months ago and had dinner with six of my MD-PhD graduates who were there at various levels during their residency and fellowship. Developing into physician scientists is really something that makes this all worthwhile. And I think that's one of the reasons that I actually like doing this part of the job. Okay, so why not just do the PhD first and then the MD? I don't think there's really necessarily any downside to that other than the fact that it might take you a little bit longer. I actually have, you know, there's a number of people who've done it that way. And you know, you don't get the integration, so you have to sort of, you know, when you're all done, work out how you're going to integrate the medical school and the PhD, but otherwise I don't know that there's any real necessarily any negative to doing it that way. Other than you're a number of years away from research because you have to do 4 years of medical school and then another 4 or 5 years of residency before you get back to research, and so that's going to be a long time, but other than that, that's probably the
How do I balance my life with my other interests and hobbies? Well, some people would say my MD PhD students are my hobby because I spend a lot of time in this position. I'm actually somewhat lucky now because my kids are actually grown. My daughter's at Duke as an undergrad, and as I mentioned, my son is starting an MD PhD program at UCSF this year. So they have not been around for a few years, and so that's allowed me to actually sort of take time that I used to spend with my family and now actually do other additional things that I can do administratively. And that's one of the reasons it's allowed me to take on a little bit more responsibilities from that point of view. And then the other thing is, you know, in the jobs we do, we get to travel a lot. I actually enjoy traveling, going out to eat at nice restaurants, you know, figuring out what their specialty is, that sort of thing. You can fit that all in. And the other thing is, the whole reason we do this job is love it. I mean, I love coming to work every day. I love working with the students. I love doing my research. I love doing the clinical work. And if I didn't do that, I wouldn't be able to handle all the time that it takes. So, did I have my kids while I was in my MD PhD? The answer is actually not while I was in my MD PhD. I actually had both of my children when I was in residency. I had my son 24 hours after I finished my internship year. Her interns all quite happy that I made it through and had all my call done before I actually had him. And then I had my daughter two years later. And I was able to do that a little bit because I was in what was essentially a research residency, although it wasn't called as that at that time. And so I was able to take off, you know, 6 weeks after my son was born. And then I started in the lab doing research. And by the time my daughter was born, I actually had just finished residency and had just started my assistant professor position. And that gives you a little bit more. You got your own office, you know, gives you a little bit more freedom, that sort of thing. So it actually worked out well for me. It wasn't necessarily planned that that's exactly how it was done. Back when I trained, MD PhD students didn't have kids because we didn't actually have health insurance to cover delivery. So it actually just wasn't done because there was no way really to get it covered. Nowadays, that's not true. Actually, I have probably more than a handful of students in my program that actually are married and have children. So it clearly can be done. And I think that it's a little easier to have your kids when you're an MD PhD when you're in your graduate years than when you're in your medical years because there's a lot more flexibility. But otherwise, in general, it doesn't really slow you down. I had one student that it actually did slow down a little bit because of the time off and that sort of thing. But most students actually, you know, have their kids pick up 6 weeks, come back to work, and just keep on going. And it works pretty well. So the MBPhD is a long process. Do I feel like the skills and other benefits of earning both degrees is worth the extra time? So, I don't know that I think that you're going to get a higher income further along in the career getting an MD-PhD versus an MD, okay? I think it's pretty clear that the reason to do the MD-PhD and to become a physician scientist is because you love this and you cannot see yourself being satisfied with doing just medicine or just science, and that you want to be able to do both and combine both. It's pretty clear that if you want to do a regular MD and go out in private practice, you're going to make a lot more money than you do as a physician scientist in an academic medical center. Now, that being said, I make good money. I think the way I normally try to explain it to people right now is that, you know, those out doing private practice, they're probably in the top 1%. I'm in the top 2%, okay? So, you know, I'm making good money. I don't necessarily have time to even spend it all the time, but if I want to spend it and I, you know, then I can. I mean, my daughter's going to be in South Africa in a couple of months. She wants to know if we can come. So I'm going to fly to South Africa. I can do that because I have enough money. So I'm not, you know, I think getting the MD PhD, you're not doing it because of the money that you're going to make.
If you want to look at money, then you have to do the regular MD. Now, that being said, MD PhDs make more money than PhDs do because you make money on an MD scale instead of a PhD scale. But we have other responsibilities. And so I think that you have to think about what is it that you love, what really drives you, where is your passion, and if it's in both the MD and the PhD, then I would say go for it. So I think you have advantage of training grant funding over traditional PhD, during the PhD years over traditional PhD students. It's a little bit of a difficult question to answer. MD PhD have the ability to apply for a specific grant funding mechanism from the NIH known as the F30. As of now, this year, all NIH actually offer that grant mechanism, and only MD PhD students can apply for it. So in a way, you would think that would be an advantage because there's fewer MD PhD students compared to the PhD students. However, you have to realize that MD PhD students are a very selective population, and they are a very high-performing population. And so although you're competing against fewer students, they're actually very good students. And so whether or not it's easier to get funding, I think, is going to remain to be seen once we actually sort of see the percentage that are actually getting funded through the various institutes. The F31, which is the PhD version of that fellowship, is now open in all institutes also. So we will be able to actually have better data to answer that question in the future. Right now, it's a little bit more difficult to say whether or not you actually have an advantage during your PhD. Let's see, where are we? So I think there's a correlation between diabetes and Alzheimer's. That's a good question. I don't know if I know the answer to that. I'm trying to think if I've actually heard anybody talk about the correlation. Question. I don't know if I think there is or not. Certainly both are on the rise. So if you believed in just correlation, but I don't actually know the answer to that. Can I talk a little bit more about my transition from residency to faculty position? So I may not be the best source of information for this question. And that is because, and I don't know if I actually should admit this, on a taped session, but I've never actually applied for a job in my life. So when I was a resident, I was offered the job at WashU as an assistant professor, and I actually took over running the clinical immunology lab when I was a resident because we didn't have a faculty member there that could join. So I transitioned into a faculty position at my own institution. Most people will say that's not a good thing because you aren't in a strong position to negotiate. I actually did not, now that I know things about this, and when I look back, I actually did not get a very good package. I didn't get much startup funds. I got enough to do what I needed to do, but I certainly did not get the same kind of package that people coming in from the outside did. And I had no training in how to negotiate, no training in how to do that faculty negotiation. And that translated into the fact that, you know, a number of years later when I moved to UAB and I was offered this position at UAB, I didn't apply for it. And again, I was offered what I thought was a reasonable package and I just took it. I didn't negotiate. I didn't, you know, hold out for more money or more startup. And in retrospect, I probably should have because I probably could have gotten more money. And so I think that's actually one thing that we don't do a very good job of teaching our MD PhD students is how to negotiate and how to do those sorts of things. And that's actually one of the things that I've been working on to try to get into place for our students, although I don't think we've done it quite well yet. But that's something, you know, in a program to talk to people to really sort of, you know, get that kind of information because I think it's actually very useful. Let's see. Oh, and how did I narrow my research after my postdoc and my residency?
So I actually sort of just combined my research from my residency and postdoc into starting my own lab. I always knew I wanted to go back to immunology, and actually the whole reason I chose my postdoc lab was in order to actually learn about gastroenterology so I could combine the two. So that was kind of my thought process all along. Stephanie, I'm working on my honors thesis. And next summer I want to do a research experience for undergrads. Is this enough, or should I take another year? So if this sounds like, if that's a year plus one summer, then that's probably not enough. If it's 2 years plus a summer, then that's probably close to the average of what. I mean, most of our successful applicants have at least a couple of years during their academic time as undergrads, plus at least some summers of research. If they don't have that, then usually they will do at least after their undergrad experience. Okay, so is that it? Are we done?
I think
one more minute.
Yeah, we can go ahead and stop there. Well, if you have any closing words.
Closing words?
You've answered.
I think that my closing words would just be, you know, if this is what you want to do, then you should go for it. I think this is the best career that there is. It's very flexible. You know, as a woman, I've been able to juggle my family, do all of the things I do, and still be an academic pathologist. And as I said before, I mean, I love what I do, and I don't think I would have probably let my son go into this career if I didn't believe that this was a fantastic career for someone who loves to do both clinical work and research. And so if it's what you want, you know, if you apply this round, you don't get in, try again, okay? My husband actually died 3 times before he got in, and he's a chair. So you know, don't let it stop you. If you don't get in the first time, if this is really what you're passionate.
Yeah, and I would actually absolutely echo that. I'm in the sixth year of my MD-PhD program in Mississippi, so just a stone's throw from Dr. Lorenz, and I'm absolutely loving it. I'm preparing my dissertation, so it's, you'd think I'd be mired in it, but it's actually been a blast, and it's just being able to help younger folks come along. I mean, you're never too young to mentor folks. So all you guys applying, be helping out the freshmen, the sophomores at your colleges, and if you're an MD-PhD program, be helping out undergrads, and that's what we're trying to do with APSA, and we're really trying to start reaching out to undergrads, so we encourage all of you. I think the membership is $10 per year, but we're really trying to help undergrads along, and one thing we're starting for undergrads is actually a mentoring program where we'll connect one-on-one. Undergrads will be connected with MD-PhD students for a one-year-long mentoring relationship. So be looking on the APSA website for that. I think we will require folks to be APSA members to take part in that, so it's just another reason to join. But thank you, Dr. Lorenz, for your time. We really appreciate it. It's been great. It's been very well attended, and I think this is the most questions we've received so far. So thank you very much.
Fantastic. Well, I'm happy to help out, and I've enjoyed it.
All right. Have a good night, everyone.